I'm Christopher Lydon with the novelist Kevin Powers, who has written, some say, the first literary masterpiece of the Iraq War. The Yellow Birds was shortlisted for the National Book Award. It won the Penn Hemingway Fiction Prize in Boston last weekend. My question is why, like so many horrifying war masterpieces, The Yellow Birds leaves us feeling so helpless to fight the next onset of the madness. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Kevin Powers, congratulations and endless admiration for this book, of which the short form could be, it was just as bad as we knew in our gut it was. Young kids scared out of their wits 24/7 asking, why the fuck are we in Iraq?
I'm happy to be with you. Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is an old fight that we're having. This is not new knowledge, the fact that war is terrible and destructive, and not just to the individual, but to communities and nations. But it does seem to me that, you know, until we can say those things in the past tense, it's important to continue to make that statement as emphatically as we possibly can.
The counter to that, which comes to my mind reading your book, is William James, who, in the moral equivalent of war, said, we're born to war. It's in our genes. We got to find some other way to exercise it. But he said, showing war's irrationality and horror is of no effect on modern man. The horrors make the fascination. War is the strong life. It's life in extremis. War taxes are the only ones that men never hesitate to pay.
No, and I think there is truth in that statement. People are fascinated by the kind of exoticism of war or any sort of extreme situation. One of the reasons I thought it was important to try to tackle the questions that I had, and I think the reason that war literature in itself is so important, is that no one should ever have the excuse of we didn't know what it would be like. I mean, that excuse should not be available to us. You know, we do have the profound ability to kind of to hurdle over our knowledge about the horrors of war, but it does seem important to make a record of what it's like, what it does to people.
Well, there's the rub, because we knew all along it was crazy. We knew there was something horrific coming, and it hadn't been explained. It hadn't been voted.
Well, I think we should have been able to imagine it. It seems to me that enough people said loudly enough that, trust us, it will be different this time. And enough people believed that it was allowed to happen. So certainly there were people who were aware of what it would really be like, particularly people who had lived through the experience of Vietnam, and even generals who were vocal about the kind of war effort that would be necessary. And when they spoke the truth, they were dismissed. So there were certainly a large number of people who understood the kind of magnitude of what we're getting into. But, you know, as seems to always be the case, there were enough people who were happy to believe that somehow our kind of American exceptionalism would lead us to, you know, this sort of bloodless war that would be easy to win and that would last 2 weeks and it would be over and we'd have access to oil and wealth and it just these absurd ideas that that have a tenuous relationship to reality at best.
What was your own story, Kevin? You were 17 when you enlisted and volunteered, barely out of high school in Virginia. What did you expect?
I signed up before we were engaged in combat. I signed up before 9/11. I expected to serve my country. I thought it was an honorable way of getting my education paid for. I wasn't a good student in high school. I don't come from, my family doesn't have a lot of money. So I just thought that, you know, as is fairly common in the part of the country that I grew up in, I'll do my bit. Get out and, you know, it'll open up some opportunities for me.
You lived the war as a private in the Army Infantry in Iraq, like John Bartle in the book, but you made up this heartbreaking story of Murphy, Bartle's pal, whom he'd promised to bring back alive. Where did the Murphy story come from, about this 18-year-old from rural Mountain Virginia who lost it in Iraq and then died an unspeakable death?
In part, I was looking for a kind of way of compressing and distilling these ideas that I had about the sort of general fear and the general anxiety that I had about the possibility that I would die myself, the possibility that people I cared about would die. I wanted to find a way to examine the kind of the limits of our loyalties to each other, not just as soldiers, but also as Americans, the kinds of commitments that we make, our desire to be good and failing utterly. The kind of instigating event for what would become that aspect of the book. When I was in Iraq, I heard, and I'm sure other people heard, this kind of apocryphal story of this private who got drunk and took off all his clothes and went outside the wire, as they say. And for me, that was that story, I'm sure, was invented out of the fears of the soldiers who were telling it. But that story kind of encapsulated the fears that I had about my own experience, the kind of the powerlessness, the existence on this border of control over your emotions and the kind of recognition of the way that your moral center is being knocked out of alignment. And, what's at stake for the individual? And I remember after I got home thinking about what would cause a person to arrive at that place and then what would happen to them? How would that affect the people around them? And what would I do if I was tasked with the responsibility of recovering that person, or if I had been responsible for that person to begin with? So it seemed like an effective way of asking all of those questions and examining all of those issues.
How many guys did you see losing it gradually? A look in their eye, an absence, an awareness that something was just breaking down in the troops around you?
Well, the thing that's so strange, and the thing that had such a profound impact on me when I got home, was the realization that, although it is absolutely true that these kinds of processes are going on, we adapt to them, and we almost don't notice it. It becomes normal, this mutation, this kind of, this ability to survive in that environment, and for some people, the character of Sergeant Sterling would be one to thrive in that environment. It was so odd to me when I had time to reflect. And one of the striking things is the way that adaptation becomes such a maladaptation when you get back home. But, even in myself, just kind of reflecting on my own experience, I remember moments of lucidity where I recognized what was happening to me, and I recognized the way that my own moral center was being kind of knocked out of alignment.
Give us the moment.
It's probably something that happened more than once, but I think we were on patrol once, and we were dismounting our vehicles and pulling security on a kind of a ridgeline, Mosul, and I recognized that, in fact, we were on the walls of ancient Nineveh. And something about that recognition was so alarming to me that we were in this place that was really in the cradle of civilization. Mm. What are we doing here? Why am I here? I mean, knowing that, my job as a soldier was to kill people. I mean, that's ultimately, if you're wearing that uniform, you're carrying a weapon, that is what your job comes down to. And it was so staggering to me in that moment, but then that moment passed, and moments like that would come and go.
We spoke about the sort of willful ignorance going in. Strikes me, 10 years after the war began, I wonder if we even begin to get it. I'm thinking of an interview I did with Anthony Shadid before his last tour over there. He was back home. This was a sort of second home for him. And he said it was terribly depressing to come back from the war to the States and realize how little of the essential story had penetrated even alert newspaper readers, even readers of his own copy, as if they didn't understand that it was our job over there to destroy Iraq. And we bloody well did. And it might not ever recover. It will surely be 50 years before it comes back to a kind of wholeness. But why don't we get it?
I don't know. Being a person who saw that firsthand and who came back and asked that same question, I mean, I think one of the things that enables so many people to not engage with the reality of the situation is the fact that so few people are affected by those choices in a direct way. I mean, the military comes from a very small percentage of the population. So very few families have to deal with, you know, their sons or daughters coming home gravely injured or killed. You know, there are really no demands on the economy. I mean, there are no kind of shortages of any kind. So people don't have to deal with it.
Dave Eggers has already said this is about the saddest book he's ever read. So let me just be bold and say it made me almost sick, Kevin. Full of admiration for every word you wrote. And yet, there's just an outrageous unreality about the war cliches that we're fed. And I'd love you to read some from the book, but I mean, a citizen like me, who is always, shall we say, highly skeptical about this war, just feels, oh my God, that's 10 years out of my life, out of this country's life, and we'll never get it back.
It's absolutely true.
What might we have done on citizens' intuition that this is a disaster in the planning and the conception and all the motivation, and surely is going to be in the results?
It seemed obvious to me. I remember sitting in my car before the war began, listening to the radio, listening to the debate in Congress over the authorization. And I just had the feeling that the basis for those votes, the thing that those people were accountable to, was misdirected. The accountability was in the wrong place. They didn't seem to be accountable to the realities of what would happen, that they were asking hundreds of thousands of young men and women to risk their lives, to die, to destroy, to kill. The fact that that wasn't the kind of primary motivating factor in it seemed to be, I mean, obviously there were people who voted their conscience, so forth. But it seemed the vast majority of people were accountable to something else. I don't know if we can define exactly what that entity is that they were accountable to, but it doesn't seem to be that it was they were accountable to reality. What people could do or could have done, you know, there were obviously demonstrations. People tried to make their voices heard. The scale, I think, was probably not what the situation justified. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it justified a louder outcry, a louder resistance.
The scale was big,
yeah,
but it wasn't heard and it wasn't covered in the media. I remember going to New York on February 15th and hoping to see my other doubters there at the United Nations. And the city government of New York, under Mayor Michael Bloomberg, had blocked all the streets of the side streets of the East Side, so you couldn't get to the UN, and you couldn't see the others. And the story was not covered in the New York Times the next day. Lincoln Chafee, who is now the governor of Rhode Island, was in the U.S. Senate at the time. He was the only Republican who voted against the Bush war authorization. And he says, I think he means it to this day, anybody who voted for that war should be disqualified from public office. And yet, the fascinating thing is that the politicians who voted for it, John Kerry eventually, Hillary Clinton, and many, many others, are still big players in our government. And to my mind, even more striking, the news institutions that approved the war are still our so-called news institutions, and commentators, and authorities.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I do wonder what mechanism is in place to make people accountable for the decisions that they've made. You know, I don't know what that mechanism is. What exists in each individual person's conscience, I don't know. I imagine there's a kind of accounting that is going on there, I would hope.
But you wonder. I mean, in the medical profession, there are malpractice suits. We don't do it in journalism, but I wonder if we should. We don't do it in politics. Well, they're called elections.
Right. No, I think in 2008, it did seem to me that one of the reasons people were so drawn to the president was that he had been upfront about his opposition to the war, that he had opposed it. And people at that time, I don't know if it was entirely a referendum about that. I don't think it was. But it did seem to be a big factor in people's attraction to him as a candidate that he said, I had opposed this war, and I will get us out of it. But on a kind of larger institutional scale, that same kind of effort and political will from the people toward our representatives doesn't seem to have had the same kind of effect.
And yet we know we're in an unreal place, as Bartle does on home leave in Virginia at some point. Would you read that passage?
Absolutely. I had become a kind of cripple. They were my friends, right? Why didn't I just wade out to them? What would I say? Hey, how are you, they'd say. And I'd answer, I feel like I'm being eaten from the inside out. And I can't tell anyone what's going on, because everyone is so grateful to me all the time. And I feel like I'm ungrateful or something. I'll give away that I don't deserve anyone's gratitude. And really, they should all hate me for what I've done. But everyone loves me for it, and it's driving me crazy. Right.
That describes all of us in a certain fashion. Let me say, it's a gorgeously written book, and it made me sick, practically.
And you know, that was the intention, I think. This is, you know, the result of this kind of sickness is further sickness. You know, I didn't want it to be accusatory. You know, I wanted that sadness, that grief over what happened to these characters and what happened to us. I wanted that to be unavoidable. I didn't want the reader to be able to look away from that.
Kevin Powers, there's a beautiful imaginative piece of this book after the death of Bartle's pal Murph. His body floats down the Tigris River, and there's a meaning in that ending. Throw your light on it.
What I was trying to explore at the end of the book was, one, the kind of power, the freeing power of the imagination. I mean, Bartle has essentially a daydream about what he thinks or hopes happened to his friend. And what he imagines is that after he has been delivered into the water of the Tigris by Bartle, by his friend.
Against all regulations, of course.
Absolutely. It is the decision that he makes to dispose of the body in this way runs counter to everything that he would have learned in the military culture. But I think his instinct is that this is the appropriate thing to do for his friend. This is the kind gesture. And what he imagines at the end of the book when he's sitting in this field, isolated and alone, is that he imagines this body will return to nature in a way. Not that it will necessarily have any kind of redemptive power, but that the natural order of things will be restored for that one person, or that one person will be restored to the natural order of things. He's been a part of and a victim of something so utterly unnatural, and he's been killed by it, and he's had to live through it and suffer it. And at the end, the decision that Bartle makes to return him to the natural order, to free him from the destructive power of mankind, is, I think, it's something that he intuits. I mean, it's not a conscious decision on Bartle's part, but I think he recognizes that by doing that, by putting him in the river, by allowing him to decompose, to be stripped away, to be reduced to material and flesh and the remains of flesh, that he's freeing him again from the destructive hands of mankind.
He imagines his skeleton turning up somewhere in Shat al-Arab or into the Gulf and into eternity. He's consumed by fish. It's a sort of sea version of a sky burial. It was an astonishing coincidence for me that at the Penn Hemingway Awards, the nonfiction went to Bernd Heinrich, who's written a book called Life Everlasting. I've read it and interviewed him about it. I never expected to see him there, but it's about precisely that sort of burial. Burial the natural way, consumed by other animals, but restored to life in some strange way. As Bernd Heinrich says, it's not from dust we come, to dust we shall return. It's from life we come, and to life we shall return. And there's something of that in your, is it or isn't it a redemptive ending?
Right. Throughout the book, I'm interested in kind of questions of scale, of our human proportions, you know, one of the kind of primary ways of looking at the war that I engage in is the fact that Bartle recognizes how tiny and powerless he is, how awed he is by the force of the war, how terrifying it is. But in a way, I mean, that scale is the root of the sublime, right? I mean, it's the root of a kind of a way of accessing humility. And he, I think at the end, this gesture, when he begins that journey for Murph, when he puts him in the river and lets him start that journey, he's flipping that, and he's returning that proportion. He's returning that scale to where it belongs. He allows his friend to become again part of the world.
This is really a stretch, but I mean, is there an analogy to be drawn with nations, with countries, with societies recovering or, you know, dying into life?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a direct line, but I think the important thing for me, one of the things that I believe very deeply, is that succumbing to this idea that nothing we do matters is the worst thing that we can do. Believing that if I do one small thing that it won't make any kind of a difference. For me, beginning with the notion that doing one thing, whether it's for one person or you know, for one small piece of ground or whatever the case may be for the individual, that matters, and that can matter forever. That seems to be, you know, I don't know if it's a way of living, but in my own life anyway, it's something that's allowed me to keep the cynicism at bay.
You leave a lot for any reader to think about, Kevin Powers. Thank you so much, and thank you for this conversation.
It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Kevin Powers. His first novel, which won the Penn Hemingway Award for Fiction this spring, is The Yellow Birds. Thanks also to Amy McDonald and the Kennedy Library staff in Boston for helping with arrangements. This conversation about what all of us let ourselves know about the misery and the waste of war isn't over until listeners like you speak for yourselves with a comment on our website at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.